The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Outskirts Science Fiction Theater on Avid Reader Nation. The Interest Rate Solution by Bronson Bryce is this financial author's key 100-year-old technique to save tens of thousands, knowing what to expect from interest rates. As everyone was calling for much higher rates, they rose from 60-year lows. Why not? Then stopped lower than the levels of 4 and 5 years ago. Find out more about the Interest Rate Solution at www.mortgageinterestratesolution.com and buy it on Amazon.com. BarnesandNoble.com, Google Books, and at dozens of other online bookstores. On your way to get this book, listen to Bronson Bryce discuss it with host Heather Wagenhals on Unlock Your Wealth radio show. Submit to the Dark Side, Stories to Explain the Stains is a book like an open window to the underworld of black sex. Everything you could have imagined is in this book of short stories. The scenes are graphic, and the wordplay will get you so hot, you will have to touch it or get Read for yourself and see what everyone's been talking about. Buy the special edition of Submit to the Dark Side, Stories to Explain the Stains, only from thedramaprincess.com. Well, hello there. It's nice to meet you here for this episode of the Outskirts Science Fiction Theater podcast. I am LaDrama Princess, the eroticist and author myself. It's science or speculative fiction every Saturday when I'm on the air for Outskirts Sci-Fi with one of my guests. Tonight, the man of the hour is Wayne Hills. Hello, Wayne.
Hi. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you? Are you ready?
I am ready, yeah. I've read through it once already just to make sure my lips work. I'm ready.
Okay. So what are you going to read tonight? You're reading Juggling Memories, right?
Yeah, I'm reading Juggling Memories, a story that I had published in a book, an anthology published by Witty Bard Publishing called Of the Dead and Dying, Tales of the Apocalypse, available on Amazon. Roughly a dozen anthologies I'm in. Under both my pen name, Wayne Hills, and my real name, Miguel A. Rueda, this one is under Wayne.
Okay. So
it has some swearing in it, so hopefully you don't have any children listening. Lock them up. Not a lot.
Well, you know. But you know, you have 15 to 30 minutes to read, and I'm going to keep quiet on mute while you're reading, so you can go ahead when you're ready.
Okay. Thank you. This is Juggling Memories by Wayne Hills. Pelt him, Carl. What the fuck you think I'm trying to do, Jeb? An empty beer can bounced off the clown's forehead. His rhythmic bowling pin juggling didn't miss a beat. Ha, good one, Carl. I thought for sure he'd drop him that time. He the best, little bro. Got nerves of steel, don't he? Jeb chugged the remainder of his natural light and threw the can in the Babu the Magnificent's direction. At the peak of his career, Babu had been a featured performer under the Big Top's many spotlights. He brought wonder to thousands, children young in life and adults young at heart. 3 years after his death, he stood in a shed deep in the heart of a Florida swamp, entertaining a pair of redneck brothers under the light of a mosquito-infested fluorescent tube. The brothers had been born less than a year apart to a mother whose affinity for sex and parties brought about their existence, and it was integral in the lives until her disappearance. Jeb's aluminum missile flew over Babu's head, through the open side of the shabbily constructed shack and into the murky water. The can landed next to a dozen others near the tail of their simply named captive gator, Gator. Their lean-to hideout, constructed from mismatched pieces of wood stolen from nearby construction sites, was built in a secluded area of the humid swampland land near their home. They cut a crude window into the wall opposite the swamp. Power for the lights, bug zapper, and college dorm-sized refrigerator came from a small generator, also stolen, which sat just outside the opening. The brothers built the structure primarily to have a place to keep Gator. Antagonizing the changed reptile wasn't as much fun as it used to be, now that they had the undead to toy with. 9 months ago, 2 years after the first reports of the dead refusing to stay dead had circulated, Babu was pulled from his grave, baggy costume, flappy shoes, and all. He didn't vacate his final resting place all on his own. None of the stubborn dead did. They weren't out for blood or chasing the living through the streets. There were no mass killings, no large-scale outbreaks of the reincarnated. They just stopped being dead. The TV said they come back doing what they was doing when they died, right? Carl said as he fed another pilfered chicken to Gator. Who come back doing what? Jeb answered. The deadens. They wake up and do whatever they was doing before. I don't know, I guess. Yeah, little bro, they do. Listen, I heard about this one that croaked while screwing one of them hoochie girls in the back of Clyde's bar. Middle of the remembrance service, that deadened get out of the box and try to hump the preacher. They said that pastor crapped his pants. Now, that's some funny shit there, bro. Jeb wasn't laughing. Carl, you think that means Mama will come back? I doubt it, dumbass. Unless you see Gator's turds crawling back up out of the swamp, I think we're good. Hell, even if she was still in one piece, she'd just want to go shoot up some more, and then she'd probably just OD. Why you gotta be so dumb all the time, Jeb? Jeez. I'm not dumb, Carl. Mama always said it was slow, but I ain't dumb. And that's not right anyway. Shooting up didn't kill her. We did. Last thing she was doing was yelling at me that I didn't have the balls to pull the trigger. Well, then, we got the last laugh, didn't we? You pull that fucking trigger, and then I helped chop her up and feed her to Gator. Kind of felt bad for him. Never saw an alligator refuse a fresh kill before. Meat gets too old and stanky, sure. See that all the time. A fresh, bloody meal? That was a surprise. He did eat her, though. You told me he ate her. Carl, don't go fucking lie to me. She gone, right? Yep, little bro, she gone and ain't coming back. Carl started waving a dismembered chicken wing at his younger brother. What's the matter, baby brother? You miss her diddling your little Jeb bone? You want Mama to come sneaking into our room all coked up, wanting to play jerk the gherkin some more? No, Carl, fuck you. I didn't like it any more than you did. I wouldn't have helped you get rid of her if I did. I'm just messing with you, little bro. Just playing. Carl threw the wing into Gator's open jaws. Come on, Jeb. We got to get my birthday present to pick up. Get the Gator stick. We got to go. Jeb grabbed the 8-foot-long hickory pole they used to prod Gator into a frenzy when things got too dull around the campsite. Gator had learned what the stick was for, and when it was near, he'd submerge himself in the deeper end of the small pond that ringed the stump his heavy 10-foot chain was fastened to. If the boys wanted to play, they had to wade into the water to coax Gator out of hiding. He seemed to know this, and over time, forced the boys deeper into the swamp whenever the pole came into sight. The boys had grown up in the same small town on the edge of the Florida Everglades that the Ryerson Family Circus used as a winter home base. Their mother worked for the family, as did the men who were the boys' fathers and the numerous uncles that Mama brought back to their double-wide trailer. The frequent extended family visits forced the boys out into the wetlands to find their own entertainment. Being the predators in the woods was far more enjoyable than dealing with the predators in their home. When they were old enough, which meant out of diapers and strong enough to carry a bucket of swamp water, they worked for the family too, putting up tents, setting up and repairing equipment, caring for and abusing the animals in the petting zoo. Any odd job that the circus's performers were deemed too talented to do. Snatching a body from a grave was surprisingly easy. In their area of the Sunshine State, the water table was typically 6 inches above ground level through most of the year. Babu, due to his status as one of the circus's troop's biggest and most popular draws, had been interred in a mausoleum decorated with all the symbols of a life in front of adoring fans. Marble and granite oversized flowers, balloons, al fresco fireworks frozen in mid-burst all adorned the structure. The brothers had no trouble prying open the steel doors. Once inside, the crypt held three recessed vaults. Encased behind glass on the wall opposite the entrance were photos of Babu's life. Of course, there was one of him juggling, another one making balloon animals. There was a wide shot of him balancing on one foot on top of a large red and white ball. Many smaller images of the smiling faces of his fans. Only two of the pictures were of the man sans his public attire. Even those, in a way, depicted his connection to his circus life. One was a black and white photograph taken from behind. It was of him holding the hand of a young girl in a leotard as they watched elephants pulling ropes to raise the big top's huge tent. The other was a formal family portrait of him and a woman who appeared to be his wife. She was holding a swaddled baby in her arms. They were standing in front of a huge Ryerson Family Circus billboard. The sign featured a cartoon image of Babu juggling his famous clubs. This image was surrounded by illustrated images that would be expected to be of an advertisement for a traveling carnival. It was the last photo taken of Babu and his family. Less than a week after it was taken, his beloved spouse died when a car she was traveling was struck by a drunk driver. Babu threw himself into his work and devoted himself to his infant daughter. When asked, he would say that the job, the life of a clown, had chosen him. The big shoes, the colorful baggy clothing, even the red ball nose and grease paint makeup had all found him. And this was the way the brothers uncovered him, interred in the uniform of an entertainer. While Jeb kept watch, Carl smashed the heavy concrete cover, exposing the casket. They were surprised to hear a steady thump, thump, thump coming from inside the dark cherry wood box. What the hell? He trying to get out? Jeb pointed the pole towards the coffin, ready to stab whatever popped out. Don't be a dipshit, little bro. They don't try to get out. Just hold a flashlight while I break open the box. Jeb lowered his weapon and pointed the light as his brother instructed. Carl said, we'll open her up, then we see what we see, all right? He broke the lock, securing the lid, and opened the coffin. Whoa, dude, that's some freaky shit. Jeb stepped forward and looked into the coffin to see Babu the Magnificent lying in his velvet-lined box, juggling invisible pins. Well, Jeb, Carl said, I guess we got to stop in town and steal this boy a couple bowling pins. For decades before, popular culture had conditioned humans to expect a bloody zombie apocalypse. Some people were genuinely disappointed when the undead seemed to want nothing more than to do whatever the hell they'd been doing just before they died. There had been no public hysteria when the resurrections began. When the dead who had been terminally ill before passing came back, their clouded gray eyes would open, and more times than not, they'd just rock slowly side to side, as if unsure what they needed to do. The dead that were buried stayed buried. Since none of them had been clawing at the inside lid of a coffin before death, they had no reason to do so after. But the people who passed away while active would mimic the movements associated with their memories. They were the fun ones. These were the ones certain redneck boys looked for. Babu's grease paint makeup had faded over time, and he'd lost his red nose when the boys led him to their pickup. Carl used epoxy to glue on a new bulb he made from a tennis ball. Then they sprayed it red at the same time they painted on a white and blue of the clown's face. Carl had said, not only won't he fade, but that some bitch won't never rust neither. Over the next several months, Carl returned to the cemetery and brought back more of the helpless creatures. Unknown to either of the boys, Carl had snatched Jeb's father from a section of the Ryerson graveyard used to inter the more common members of the circus family. Of the dozen helpless creatures they used as their playthings, this was the only one that Gator actually snapped at when it was brought near the water. Carl was surprised to learn that the dead ones could show fear. None of their collection proved to have the same flair for performing as Babu, so they were used mostly for target practice before being forced out into the swamp to wander, hopelessly searching for whatever it was that they needed to find. The one the boys released weren't able to go very far from the small pool cleared by Gator's chain. Invariably, they would become entangled in thick vines or mired in the deep, soft mud of the marsh. On Jeb's 18th birthday, the brothers walked the familiar path down to the shack. Jeb, I got your present. You're going to like this one, little bro. Oh, hell, Carl, you always say that. Ain't none of them turn out to be any fun. They're not any good to hunt. They don't even try to get away. Most of them just lie down and roll around unless we poke them with the gator's pole. Not this one, bro. Considering she's been in a box for almost 4 years, this chick's still hot for a deadin'. She's our age, well, was when she died in the ring, just like the clown. She's a gymnast. So she's going to be doing backflips and shit, Carl? Won't you just flip over in the gator? No, man, I got it covered. You'll see. Jed got the first look at his present as the brothers emerged into the clearing by the shack. Carl had strapped the girl to a crude trapeze and suspended it from a branch. The crossbar, fashioned from a 3-foot-long length of electrical conduit, was tied to ropes that were run through pulleys and knotted to a cleat on the wall near the window. Jeb froze mid-step. Wow, thanks, man. That's really cool. You ain't seen the best part. She'll keep swinging on her own once you get her going. Watch. With Babu juggling nearby, Carl picked up the pole and pushed her back. When she was as far up as he could get her, he dropped the stick. As she sprung forward, she began to use her arms to create momentum, throwing herself back and forth in time with the movement of the trapeze. A gap-toothed smile appeared through the mud and scruff on Jeb's face. On the sixth swing, just as she reached the highest point in her trajectory, she tried to rock herself up into a sitting position. Failing to make it up onto the bar, her body went limp, and the swinging stopped. Jeb's smile fell. What the hell, Carl? You said she'd keep going. No sweat, Jeb. Here, you try it. He handed Jeb the rod. Every couple times she tries to sit up. That's why I used the duct tape to hold her on there. Hell, first time I tried it, she flipped right off and landed on her feet. Hell if I know how she did that. The tape seems to keep her in place. Maybe she'll get the hang of it. Go on, give her a poke. As the day wore on and the summer's late afternoon thunder rumbled in the background, they added another case of natural light cans to the water surrounding Gator. Jeb would restart the girl as Carl used a slingshot to shoot milkweed pods at her breasts. As she swung, the motion brought back memories of her previous life and the fall that had ended it. 4 years earlier, she had been performing a matinee on a typical Florida summer afternoon. Another performance in the big top using apparatus set up by a pair of drunk and stone brothers. A strong gust of wind rattled the tent, jarring the ill-fitted bracing loose, dropping the young girl on the hard dirt floor, splattering her internal organs at the feet of a clown who'd been attempting to juggle 10 pins. Babu held her as she died, just as his own heart broke and he died with her. The girl struggled and twisted as Jeb laughed. He prodded her harder and higher. Babu squinted at the swinging girl and seemed to become agitated as he juggled. Neither of the drunken men heard the abused clown's groans. Carl grew tired of the moving target practice. Jeb, I got an idea. Go loosen the ropes. Jeb placed the hickory pole against the wall and began to undo the knot. Carl moved to a small table out into the clearing and placed it under their undead girl. He motioned to Jeb to lower her onto it. When her back lay flat on the weather-beaten surface, Carl said, Stop there, Jeb. We need her knees up for our next bit of fun. I've always wanted to bang a gymnast. She's an acrobat. Gymnast is different. Besides that, Carl, she's dead. Man, that just ain't right. Either way, Jeb, this here is a tight little body. And besides, she's undead. Still got some warmth to her. I ain't a complete pervert. He pushed the trapeze back and held it with his left hand as he began undoing his belt with his right. The girl lying on the table was close enough now to Babu that he finally saw her face. Recognition, then memory, and then rage arose in his rotting brain. Thunder cracked outside the small shed as Carl's grimy jeans hit the ground. Oh, shit, Carl, Jeb said. He dropped the pin. No fucking what, Jeb? Can't you see him about to get busy? No, man, Carl, he's looking at you. I mean, like he actually sees you. Carl turned to look. Although Babu's body was still angled away from the table, he had turned his head to face Carl. The steady rhythm of throwing and catching slowed as Babu continued to juggle the two remaining clubs. He appeared to be studying the table, the girl, Carl, and the distance between them. Hey, maybe the old man still got some horny left in him. Carl focused his attention back on the table and the real reason he'd grabbed the girl from the grave. Maybe when we're done, we let him give her a poke. Carl pushed the metal rod further back and up, then reached for the strapped girl's waistband. Carl, fuck! Jeb's warning came too late. With a slow grace that surprised Jeb, Babu effortlessly spun, caught a pin on its downward arc, and threw it at Carl's head. Jeb heard the skull crack as the club struck his brother's temple. Without thought, Jeb grabbed the pole used to prod Gator and charged at Babu like a knight in a nightmarish joust. Catching the clown in the chest, Jeb began pushing him back towards Gator's lagoon. Carl, Carl, you okay? Jeb screamed at his brother who lay in the mud. Blood seeped from the fissure opened in his head by the bowling pin's impact and mixed with the dark brown earth. The captive alligator, sensing that something new was happening, crawled towards the bank, stopping midway between the stump and the shore. That's right, Gator. Come help save your daddy. Carl needs you. Come on, boy. Babu swung the remaining pin at Jeb. Jeb, who managed to keep just out of reach as he pushed the clown into the swamp nearing the hissing alligator. The creature ignored the colorful leg that was now within easy reach. He continued to stare at the advancing Jeb. Get him, Gator! Bite him! Gator ignored his tormentor's command, drawing the chain taut around his body as he advanced past Babu towards the bank. Shit! Fuck you, Gator! You done too! Soon as I kill this fucking bedding, retreating back up the bank, Jeb slipped in the mossy soil, releasing enough pressure on the pole for Babu to lean forward. The shift in Jeb's weight allowed the swinging pin to drop low enough to knock the pole away. Jeb stumbled to run. As he fell forward, Babu grabbed him with both hands. Powered by muscles strengthened over decades of juggling heavy clubs, his fingernails, sharpened from months of tossing and catching, tore into Jeb's collarbones. The jungle-like environment muffled Jeb's screams as Babu effortlessly lifted him from the ground and threw him into the murky water of the swamp. Gator's open mouth followed the trajectory of the flying boy, and as Jeb's body hit the water, Gator revealed he had much more play in his metal tether than he had let on. The reptile's wide body shot past Jeb's kicking feet as the powerful jaws found their target, right between Jeb's knees. Babu turned back to the table. Carl lay on the ground, moaning softly. The girl returned to rocking slowly, trying to swing again, her mind recreating the moment right before her death. A muddy size 22 shoe smashed down into the older brother's skull, splattering blood and brains across the dirty white, blue, and yellow silk of the clown's baggy costume. On his third stomp, a thumb-sized glob of meat landed on Babu's upper lip. Bits of gray, streaked with blood and black slime, oozed from the fractured skull. A thin crimson slid between the stitches that held Babu's lips together. He felt the long-lost warm sensation as the wetness found its way to his black tongue. Babu was excited. The first time since all feeling had stopped, he experienced the sense of taste. Buried deep in a primordial part of his decaying DNA, something awakened. A yearning for something more than mere repetition overwhelmed him. He no longer wanted just to be, just to repeat the actions in his mind remembered from before death. He needed something more. Somehow he knew this new substance would help him get it. Strands of his curly wig fell into the puddle of growing blood as he bent over, picked up a chunk of Carl's exposed brain in his mud-stained glove, placed it on his lips. His eyes, which had been gray and sunken, began to moisten and clear. The warm juice filled him with fluid electricity that flowed down and through his chest. He remembered from his youth having a cold glass of milk as a boy. He'd imagine that cold feeling running through his veins, filling him with a jolt of power like the superheroes he's read about in his comic books. That feeling made him happy. More than that, he felt ecstatic. He didn't want that more sensation to end. He wanted to fill his mouth with it, smear it over his face, and drink it in the thick liquid. But his jaw wouldn't open. Babu jammed his fingers into his mouth. Using his razor-sharp fingernails, he sliced through his own lips, cutting the sutures used to sew them shut. Spray-painted white by the brothers, his lips were now shredded in crimson, streaked with Carl's blood. Babu fell to his knees and began to devour every bit of Carl. When there was no more easily picked from the ground, he ripped the skull apart. Splitting the bone, Babu buried his face into Carl, covering his painted face and tattered clothes with blood. His vision was now clear. Gone was the translucent covering that had been his sight since Carl first tore open his grave. Babu's lungs filled with air in short, ratcheting breaths. Eventually, he was able to take a deep, satisfying breath and look around. Now he fully saw the hell where he had been held. Although he had no clear memory of what had come before this place, then he saw the table and the writhing girl tied to a pipe. He recognized her. He gathered the remaining scraps of gore from the shattered remnants of Carl's head and stood. Inhaling another full, satisfying breath, Babu let out a low cry, a guttural call that echoed through the murk of the jungle. The sound cut through the thick leaves, reaching into long-plugged ears of his undead brethren. His daughter, Lizzie, stopped rocking and turned her clouded eyes to him. She looked at him. The feeling was no longer faint. He knew her. He looked into her eyes, reached down and smeared Carl's bloody remains onto her lips. Using the fingernail of his index finger, he gently cut her lips apart as he pushed the slimy gore into her mouth. He did this gruesome task with care in order to not tear her skin the way he had done his own. When she tasted the energizing meat, her eyes softened. Her lungs rejuvenated and filled. She, too, felt the bliss of her past life. She remembered being happy, joyful with her circus family. And like Babu, she, too, wanted the feeling never to end. Babu removed her restraints, his fingernails easy slicing through the cheap duct tape used to bind her to her makeshift trapeze. He helped her stand and embraced her. Together they screamed. Their voices filled the night air, beckoning others to join them. Around the clearing, the undead that the brothers had released into the swamp began to come to their call. No longer were they simply standing in the mire, growing a layer of slime and becoming part of the dreary landscape, unable to fulfill their desire to return to their life's last memory. They now had a purpose, a desire to follow the sound that had awakened them from their eternal quasi-slumber. Behind Babu in the marsh, Gator had ceased spinning and ripping Jeb apart. He had devoured the younger brother in much the same way Babu had Carl. The difference was that Gator always remembered everything. He wasn't eating Jeb to satisfy his appetite. The boys kept their pet well fed. Most of Gator's mind was now inhabited by the memories of a junkie whose body was no more. The alligator's thoughts were no longer solely reptilian. Mama was in control. Babu watched the undead coming towards him and knew what he had to do. Releasing Lizzie from his embrace, he walked into the swamp towards Gator, who eyed the approaching clown. Gator's death spin had entwined him in the heavy chain that bound him to the stump. Hopelessly entangled, Gator would die within a week if left on his own. As if the wild animal understood Babu's intentions, he allowed the bloody clown to lift him from the water and remove the restraints. As Babu surveyed the various parts of Jeb that remained floating in the pool, he didn't see what he needed. He began sloshing through the mud, feeling around in the dark water until he found his prize, Jeb's head. He carried his treasure back to the table, pausing only to pick up the bowling pin that had stopped Carl's attack on Lizzie. Jeb's open eyes stared out towards the swamp where he and his brother had committed their many atrocities. Babu placed the head sideways, raised the club, and smashed open his skull. The force of the impact popped Jeb's eyes from their sockets, and they hung by their stringy optic nerves, swinging like gory pendulums. He pulled bits of meat from the opening and turned towards the dead, now gathered around him. Babu was once again the center of attention. Like a priest of a nightmare church, he handed out the bloody host, one by one, to each of those surrounding him. He gently cut open their lips and fed them a bit of Jeb's brain. And as the warm meat moistened their tongues, they each recalled the happiest moment they had ever felt. And each one wanted that feeling to never end. All of them understood that there was only one way to continue to re-experience this emotion. They needed to feed on the fresh meat of a living brain. And as they left the woods, Babu juggling his blood-smeared pins, Lizzie somersaulting and jumping beside him, Babu realized that he had a purpose again. He knew how to bring renewed joy to people. And so it passed, that Babu's disciples spread the knowledge of how the undead could achieve happiness. Terror and fear finally gripped the living. Though those who believed the return of the dead would be a battle for civilization as we know it, finally got their war. How it will end is anyone's guess. Find what makes you happy. Soon, maybe very soon, you may have to feed on that memory. That's it. And
that was good. I'm here. I'm listening. That was good.
I gotta take a drink of water. Give me a sec.
Okay. Yes, I like that. I want to know what made you set the story in Florida with the circus, with the clowns or whatever and everything like that. I want to know what was the inspiration behind that.
I believe for this story there was a submission call for a clown story.
Uh-huh.
And felt like writing a zombie clown story. So that's where it started, and then it just grew from there.
Okay,
most of
the stories
that I write, I don't have a set genre that I write in. I'll look for submission calls that interest me, and then I'll write based on what the call is. So I'll write horror, or I'll write zombie, or I'll write fantasy, or whatever. It's just whatever the call is.
Okay. I see you got a nice sense of humor there.
Thank you.
I like the voices, of course. I like that. I think that makes the whole story animated and gives the listener a much more rich experience, probably better than what they can come up with in their own head because they're hearing it from the author as how they see it as they wrote it. So that was really great.
Thank you. Thank you.
So the Soul Library is one of your own. That's a short, right?
Yeah, Soul Library and what was the other one?
What is it?
Soul Flip. Yeah. Sorry. Those are the first two I ever did that I published on my own. Those two, they're only 99 cents. They're not very well edited because, again, they're the first ones that I ever actually published. I mean, I've been writing for... I'm 55 now. I've been writing for over 40 years. But just recently, thanks to one of my Facebook groups, Fiction Writers Group, that I'm a member of, they really helped prompt me into actually publishing. There's a lot of good stuff there. And it's a really good group. I know a lot of people belong to a lot of groups on Facebook, a lot of writers groups. But this one is a no-promo group. They're not endless posts, people wanting you to buy their book. They're very helpful in trying to get writers to publish and learn the craft.
Okay.
So these two books, Soul Library and Soul Flip, those I just wrote. Those just came to me and I wrote them. There was no reason they both happen to have a soul in the title. It's just it's both the stories just happen to come out that way.
Because I was going to ask you that next. Why a soul?
Yeah, there
and,
wasn't any
title.
Yeah, no nefarious background of those. It's just the way it worked out.
Okay, I'm still hung up on Juggling Memories, so I didn't know what to think about that. But I think it was just like so great. I wish it was like a whole big book. You know.
Wow. Well, I guess they can walk out of the swamp and spread their good news.
Well, you know, I want to see more of what's going on here. So I was going to ask you about the Soul Library and Soul Flip. Could you tell us a little bit more about Soul Library, though?
Soul Library is a story about a guy who, he's a security guard, he's overweight, he's not very good looking, he's kind of a loser. And he is sent on an errand by his boss to go down to a library down in the basement of the building he works in. And it's got kind of a Twilight Zone feel to it. As he's walking down to the library, he notices the farther he walks that the he's not really getting any closer to the door that he's heading for. There's no other doors in the hallway. It just seems to be the same distance. And when he turns around, he's the same place he was. It's like he never went anywhere. And then he goes to try to keep walking back to it, to the door. And then the hallway ends up just getting smaller. It's kind of a, like I said, a Twilight Zone-y thing. So when he steps through the door, first he knocks on the door and he has a flashback to his grammar school upbringing in a Catholic school. I went to a Catholic school, so I have a lot of guilt built up, I guess, from getting punished a lot. So he ends up in the library, and it's kind of a hellish library. I have a lot of descriptions of what goes on in there, where it turns out where he has done some things in his past where he might have tried to rape a woman and didn't, and then feels guilty about it, and then he starts to kind of have these pedophile feelings and hanging out in playgrounds, and he starts to turn his life around and meets a woman in the lobby of the building he works in, and one day a disgruntled employee comes in, and he jumps in front of the woman to save her life because she's really the first, she's blind, and she's really the first woman who really is taking him as who he is and not by what he looks like. And the story is kind of a purgatory story where the whole going down to the library is really his journey into purgatory to be judged.
Right.
So it was an interesting little tale.
Yeah, very creative. Okay. Not something you would hear somebody do on a regular, especially putting those elements of his life in there, you know, things that he'd done. I don't think most people would touch that. And then to make it a purgatory, I think it's very creative.
Well, one thing, I was I worked as an actor for a few years, and one of the things I learned with the group that I worked with was that art should move the viewer, whether it's a reader or it's someone watching a play or listening to a monologue. If it's just vanilla and it's just passing the time, then that's, to me, that's one of the things I got from my experience being an actor, is it's not art. I mean, I don't want to offend anybody. You do whatever you want, call yourself an artist, but art should move the viewer. That something should strike a chord, should make you joyful, should make you pissed off, should make you horny, whatever. It should move you. If not, what's the point? What's it really?
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, a lot of writers also will tell you if it doesn't move you, then it won't move anyone else. So it's really a waste of time.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't have any of that in my real background. I mean, I don't want anybody to get the wrong idea about some of the subjects.
No, I definitely wasn't thinking that. No, I don't think that way. I hope no one thought that. It's just a story. But, you know, I just think it's good.
Some of the discussions
you know,
I see on some of the boards are, you know, I hope people don't think I'm actually like my characters.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, because you get people saying, well, I write about myself. I usually have myself in my books and my characters or whatever. But I always think it's good to always try to think of something that will, you know, that you don't see every day and try to do that. Because I know people, they want to have twists in their books, but sometimes it gets too twisty and it's still passe at the same time. It's done over and over again. So it doesn't offend me of what you have in the book. I think it's cool.
Thank you.
So how did you decide on your pen name?
Well, it was kind of a goof. When I decided I wanted to start publishing my stories, my name I feel is kind of epic, Miguel A. Rueda. My middle name is Antonio. It's Colombian. My father was Colombian. And to me, it's an ethnic name. And I think that may turn some people off. So just to get started, I decided, and again, this was a goof, to use the name of the high school I graduated from, which is Wayne Hills. So my plan was, if I became rich and famous as an author, I would immediately have a high school named after me.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait a minute,
so Wayne Hills High School is named after me. Anybody from Wayne?
Where's Wayne Hills High School? Where is that, in New York?
It's in Wayne, New Jersey.
Oh, because when I was looking you up, I found a Wayne Hills. It's actually a housing development. I think there's like a whole little area in Ohio. So
oh, yeah?
I was like, what state is that? Yeah.
Wayne Hills High School, Wayne, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. So you say you write
briefly, I've started using my real name. So I actually have two Amazon pages. One's Wayne-Hills, and the other one's Miguel A. Ruedi. You got to use the A. And my Facebook page is Author Wayne Hills, and my WordPress page is Wayne Hills Author. I really should have synced those up when I set them up, but it didn't occur to me at the time. But I'm the only Wayne Hills out there.
Yeah, about the other pen names, because I found those too, that you had stuff published under your real name as well. So
yeah, so most of the stuff
I'll
be doing now is going to be Miguel Ruedi.
Okay. Is there any reason why you're getting away from Wayne Hills?
Pressure from friends and loved ones to stop hiding.
Hiding?
Yeah, you know, hiding behind the name.
Okay.
I'm not hiding. I mean, that wasn't the plan. Like I said, it was a goof. It wasn't for any other reason other than I thought my real name, I still do, think my real name is ethnic. And
well, I don't think that's a bad thing if somebody does think it is. I think it was still a unique name when I found it. I was like,
yeah,
that's a pretty cool name.
That's one of the reasons I'm starting to use it again is
yeah.
My own personal belief about it is not shared by others. So I'm well known to fold to peer pressure. So
yeah, you know, us writers get like that too. We get to thinking all this stuff in our heads, and it's not even true because you know, with our imaginations and everything, things can go awry.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, what other genres, you told me about the other genres you write in. So what are they again?
Pretty much whatever the submission calls for. I like writing fantasy, I guess, if I had to choose one. I have a couple of stories in an anthology called Dark and Never After, which is another, which is a fiction writer group publication. I have two stories in there. One is a story about a troll who rides dragons on the professional dragon riding circuit. That one originated from an NYC midnight writing competition, which I really like doing competitions because you're given prompts. I can pretty much write anything on prompts. You know, you give me a genre and three things, and I'll write a story about it. So I like the competitions. I like writing short stories. I write a lot of short stories because of my work and the commute and just my schedule. I've started some bigger projects, and I just get bogged down time and end up I'd rather just whip out a couple of 3,000 to 5,000 word stories in a couple of weeks than spend 2 years on a novel. But Darkly Never After has two of my stories in it, and I'm proud of both of those. I'm proud of that book. That's a really good book. The Darkly Never After book is a good one. It's all dark and adult fairy tales. And the proceeds from that one actually go to charity, to St. Jude's Charity.
Mm-hmm. And you share a lot of your shorts on your blog as well, right?
Yeah, I tend to write stuff on my WordPress page. If I'm working on a story, I'll post snippets of it. I have entire stories on there that I haven't published anywhere that I just, if I just feel like writing a story, I'll write a story and put it up on the blog in chapters. I have a fun ghost story going on there that I got to a point where it ended, but it's not the end. It's got more to it. I just have no idea what it is yet. So it's an interesting story. I like that one. I had a long time ago, when I was a kid, actually, decided that I wouldn't be afraid of ghosts because if a ghost killed me, I'd be a ghost too, and I'd kick his ass. So I decided to use that as the premise of a story. So if you're killed by a ghost, you team up with everybody else who was killed by that ghost and go kick his ass in the afterlife. So a ghost's story is based on that premise.
Okay.
It would work, right?
I suppose. Like I said, I like the creativity.
Thank you.
So you say you have a Colombian background. Do you ever think you or have you done something with diverse characters in it?
Diverse characters. Well, I don't think so, actually. I kind of think of all my characters as diverse. I don't really.
Well, you know, if someone's Latino background or, you know, ethnicity, do you think you would do something like that?
I wrote a story where the book that this was published in. I think this was published in a book called Deathmongers, an anthology called Deathmongers, about a. It's kind of a Romanian, Latvian kind of area, Eastern European family of vampires that lure this guy in and, you know, make him one of theirs. And it's kind of gory, interesting. Get to kill a vampire with a papermate pen, which is where the whole thought of the story came from, because I like papermates. I don't know if you can hear that click. Mm-hmm. Hear the click?
Yep.
I love the click of a papermate. It's like a mechanical thing. So I had the idea, if you try to kill a vampire and you stab him in the heart and you're just a tiny bit short, click the clicker and the ballpoint will poke out and kill him. Well, the whole story came from that little wacky thought. So that's the way my brain works. So then Deathmongers, the vampires are that Eastern European type. But that's about it. I don't really... I guess I'm going to have to start adding them. It never occurred to me. It really didn't. I just write the characters how they are. Well, this one.
Okay.
Rednecks. Do rednecks count? That's kind of ethnic.
I don't know about that. So what do you have coming up next?
I got a prompt from Woody Bard again. Woody Bard's doing a mystery. So I got a prompt to write a mystery. So I've never written a mystery, so I figured I'd give that a shot. I like noir crime stories. I just like that idea. So I'm writing a mystery in that type of story. I've started it. It's only a little bit in. I'm not really sure where I'm going with it yet. So there's not a whole lot going there. But I've got to have that submitted next month, I believe. And I have in final edits a horror story, which I'm hoping that'll be accepted in the next couple of weeks. I can't talk about that one, though.
Okay.
Can't talk about that one because it's the submission process. The way it works is it's submitted to a blind board, so they can't know what it's about, and they may be listening. Hopefully they're listening.
Okay. So how many pieces would you say are horror or fantasy or sci-fi or any type of speculative fiction? How many pieces do you think you have of those?
I'd say I'm 70% horror, zombie, that kind of stuff. I mean, it's just the way it happens to come out. Like I said, I'll write anything. I just did I thought it was a very good story, again, for NYC Midnight Competition, a drama. The prompts were drama, poverty, juggler, of all things, and something else. I forget the other thing was. But I wrote it about the poverty angle was they were Vietnam vets living in Washington Square Park in the early 70s. They had come back from Vietnam, and they were living on the just outside. They had PTSD. And one of them met another vet who was living on the abandoned World's Fair site. This is, I grew up in New York, Northern Jersey, so all of these areas and times are very familiar to me. So they travel to the World Trade, the World Fair site, the old World Fair site in Queens, when there's a big hollow Earth globe. If you ever saw the movie Men in Black, that takes place. The finale of the movie takes place at the old World Fair site. There's a big globe of the Earth, and it has the two spaceship-looking towers there. So they end up there, and the guy with the still that they went to meet for a goof decides to start juggling grenades. And as he's juggling the grenades, one of the pins falls out. And one of the main characters who the story is written about, to save his friend, dives on the grenade, and it doesn't go off. It's a dud. So he decides at that moment that he needs to straighten himself out, and him and his friend need to get help and get off the streets. The ending killed me in the competition. They loved everything about the story, but they didn't think the dud grenade was enough for him to change his life. And that, I mean, I liked the ending, but it's tough because those competitions have a set number of words. You know, you have 1,000 or 2,500 or 2,000.
Right.
So things cut. So there's backstory that was in there. When I first wrote it, I think I had to end up at 2,500. When I first wrote it out, I was probably closer to 4,000 words. So when you're doing something like that, you need to just start cutting out backstory. You need to cut out descriptions. You need to cut, because you got to get down to 2,500. You got to be at that limit. And when I did that, I ended up with no ending. I ended up with him jumping on the grenade, and I couldn't end there. So I had to cut something else and make a very short ending, and the short ending was they decided to clean themselves up, and that killed me. I love the story. I think it's a great story. I mean, I'll probably put it in. I'm going to make a compilation of my own work later this year. I'm going to put out a book of all the stuff I've had published. Everything I have in anthologies, I still retain the rights to. So all of those stories, this story, all the stories we've talked about, some we haven't, some other stories that I have cooking, will all be in that collection. And if people are interested, just watch my my Facebook page or my author pages, and it'll pop up there hopefully in the summer sometime.
Okay. Well, could you give them the Facebook page address and your blog address again?
Facebook is Author Wayne Hills. WordPress is Wayne Hills Author. Amazon, the two pages are Miguel A. Rueda, R-U-E-D-A. And I'm proud to say if you do Miguel A. Rueda in Google, I'm the first thing that pops up. But you got to put the A in there. And Amazon is Wayne-Hills, Wayne-Hills, and you'll get my Wayne Hills page.
Okay. Why do you have to use the hyphen?
I don't know. It's just the way it comes up. When I do it without the hyphen, it doesn't find me.
Oh.
I mean, you can.
Are there other Wayne Hills on there?
There's a Wayne Hill. There's a Wayne Hill. But when I use the hyphen, it comes right up.
Okay. Well, all right.
I want to show up. Throw a plug out for Fiction Writers Group on Facebook. I love that group. They're very good to me, and hopefully they enjoy my witty retorts. And All Things Zombie, ATZ, also on Facebook, is a great zombie group. If you're into zombies, All Things Zombie, is a good group to belong to. They're a fun group.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming on tonight and giving us a sample. And you gave us all your contact information. So I guess I'm going to wish you a good night.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me. I was very nervous at the beginning. I don't know if you could tell. But I had a wonderful time. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed it, too, in the reading. So
thank you.
You'll come back?
I would love to come back, yeah.
All right. Well,
I'll do voices,
we'll
too.
We'll have to hook that up. All right.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Good night.
All right, you guys. If you get a copy of Wayne Hills' work, you know what is required. Give him some appreciation and leave a review. Be sure you've subscribed to this podcast because Haley Coates is coming next week. Same bat time, 9 p.m. Eastern. Until then, come see about me, elladramaprincess.com on erotic reading. Bye-bye, hon.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.